several decisions are to be contemplated together. Imagine a longer list of five simple binary decisions to be considered simultaneously. The broad, comprehensive frame consists of a single choice with 32 options. Narrow framing will yield a sequence of five simple choices. The sequence of five choices will be one of the 32 options of the broad frame. Will it be the best? Perhaps, but not very likely. A rational agent will, of course, engage in broad framing, but humans are by nature narrow framers. The ideal of logical consistency, as this example shows, is not achievable by our limited mind. Because we are susceptible to what you see is all there is, and averse to mental effort, we tend to make decisions as problems arise, even when we are specifically instructed to consider them jointly. We have neither the inclination nor the mental resources to enforce consistency on our preferences, and our preferences are not magically set to be coherent, as they are in the rational agent model. Samuelson's problem. The great Paul Samuelson, a giant among the economists of the 20th century, famously asked a friend whether he would accept a gamble on the toss of a coin in which he could lose $100 or win $200. His friend responded, "I won't bet, because I would feel the $100 loss more than the $200 gain. But I'll take you on if you promise to let me make 100 such bets." Unless you are a decision theorist, you probably share the intuition of Samuelson's friend that playing a very favorable but risky gamble multiple times reduces the subjective risk. Samuelson found his friend's answer interesting and went on to analyze it. He proved that under some very specific conditions, a utility maximizer who rejects a single gamble should also reject the offer of many. Remarkably, Samuelson did not seem to mind the fact that his proof, which is of course valid, led to a conclusion that violates common sense, if not rationality. The offer of 100 gambles is so attractive that no sane person would reject it. Matthew Rabin and Richard Thaler pointed out that the aggregated gamble of 100 50-50 lose $100 / gain $200 bets has an expected return of $5,000 with only a 1/2300 chance of losing any money and merely a 1/62000 chance of losing more than $1,000. Their point, of course, is that if utility theory can be consistent with such an absurd preference under any circumstances, then something must be wrong with it as a model of rational choice. Samuelson had not seen Rabin's proof of the absurd consequences of severe loss aversion for small bets, but he would surely not have been surprised by it. His willingness even to consider the possibility that it could be rational to reject the package testifies to the powerful hold of the standard theory. Let us assume that a very simple value function describes the preferences of Samuelson's friend. Call him Sam. To express his aversion to losses, Sam first rewrites the bet, after multiplying each loss by a factor of 2. He then computes the expected value of the rewritten bet. Here are the results for 1, 2, or 3 tosses. They are sufficiently instructive to deserve some pupil dilating effort. One toss, 50% lose 100, 50% win 200, expected value 50. Losses doubled, 50% lose 200, 50% win 200. Expected value 0. Two tosses, 25% lose 200, 50% win 100, 25% win 400, expected value 100. Losses doubled, 25% lose 400, 50% win 100, 25% win 400. Expected value, 50. Three tosses. 12.5% lose 300, 37.5% win 0, 37.5% win 300, 12.5% win 600. Expected value, 150. Losses doubled. 12.5% lose 600, 37.5% win 0, 37.5% win 300, 12.5% win 600. Expected value, 112.5. You can see here that the gamble has an expected value of 50. However, one toss is worth nothing to Sam because he feels that the pain of losing a dollar is twice as intense as the pleasure of winning a dollar. After rewriting the gamble to reflect his loss aversion, Sam will find that the value of the gamble is 0. Now consider two tosses. The chances of losing have gone down to 25%. The two extreme outcomes, lose 200 or win 400, cancel out in value. They are equally likely, and the losses are weighted twice as much as the gain. But the intermediate outcome, one loss, one gain, is positive, and so is the compound gamble as a whole. Now you can see the cost of narrow framing and the magic of aggregating gambles. Here are two favorable gambles, which individually are worth nothing to Sam. If he encounters the offer on two separate occasions, he will turn it down both times. However, if he bundles two offers together, they are jointly worth $50. Things get even better when three gambles are bundled. The extreme outcomes still cancel out, but they have become less significant. The third toss, although worthless if evaluated on its own, has added $62.50 to the total value of the package. By the time Sam is offered five gambles, the expected value of the offer will be $250. His probability of losing anything will be 18.75%, and his cash equivalent will be $203.125. The notable aspect of this story is that Sam never wavers in his aversion to losses. However, the aggregation of favorable gambles rapidly reduces the probability of losing, and the impact of loss aversion on his preferences diminishes accordingly. Now, I have a sermon ready for Sam if he rejects the offer of a single, highly favorable gamble played once, and for you if you share his unreasonable aversion to losses. I sympathize with your aversion to losing any gamble, but it is costing you a lot of money. Please consider this question. Are you on your deathbed? Is this the last offer of a small, favorable gamble that you will ever consider? Of course, you are unlikely to be offered exactly this gamble again, but you will have many opportunities to consider attractive gambles with stakes that are very small relative to your wealth. You will do yourself a large financial favor if you are able to see each of these gambles as part of a bundle of small gambles and rehearse the mantra that will get you significantly closer to economic rationality. You win a few, you lose a few. The main purpose of the mantra is to control your emotional response when you do lose. If you can trust it to be effective, you should remind yourself of it when deciding whether or not to accept a small risk with positive expected value. Remember these qualifications when using the mantra. It works well when the gambles are genuinely independent of each other. It does not apply to multiple investments in the same industry, which would all go bad together. It works only when the possible loss does not cause you to worry about your total wealth. If you would take the loss as significant bad news about your economic future, watch it. It should not be applied to long shots, where the probability of winning is very small for each bet. If you have the emotional discipline that this rule requires, you will never consider a small gamble in isolation or be loss-averse for a small gamble until you are actually on your deathbed, and not even then. This advice is not impossible to follow. Experienced traders in financial markets live by it every day, shielding themselves from the pain of losses by broad framing. A group of neuroscientists demonstrated that experimental participants could be almost cured of their loss aversion, in a particular context, by inducing them to think like a trader, just as experienced baseball card traders are not as susceptible to the endowment effect as novices are. Students make risky decisions to accept or reject gambles in which they could lose under different instructions. In the narrow framing condition, they were told to make each decision as if it were the only one and to accept their emotions. The instructions for broad framing of a decision included the phrases, imagine yourself as a trader. You do this all the time. And treat it as one of many monetary decisions which will sum together to produce a portfolio. The experimenters assessed the subject's emotional response to gains and losses by physiological measures, including changes in the electrical conductance of the skin that are used in lie detection. As expected, broad framing blunted the emotional reaction to losses and increased the willingness to take risks. The combination of loss aversion and narrow framing is a costly curse. Individual investors can avoid that curse, achieving the emotional benefits of broad framing while also saving time and agony by reducing the frequency with which they check how well their investments are doing. Closely following daily fluctuations is a losing proposition because the pain of the frequent small losses exceeds the pleasure of the equally frequent small gains. Once a quarter is enough, and maybe more than enough for individual investors. In addition to improving the emotional quality of life, the deliberate avoidance of exposure to short-term outcomes improves the quality of both decisions and outcomes. The typical short-term reaction to bad news is increased loss aversion. Investors who get aggregated feedback receive such news much less often and are likely to be less risk-averse and to end up richer. You are also less prone to useless churning of your portfolio if you don't know how every stock in it is doing every day, or every week, or even every month. A commitment not to change one's position for several periods, the equivalent of locking in an investment, improves financial performance. Risk policies. Decision makers who are prone to narrow framing construct a preference every time they face a risky choice. They would do better by having a risk policy that they routinely apply whenever a relevant problem arises. Familiar examples of risk policies are: always take the highest possible deductible when purchasing insurance, and never buy extended warranties. A risk policy is a broad frame. In the insurance examples, you expect the occasional loss of the entire deductible or the occasional failure of an uninsured product. The relevant issue is your ability to reduce or eliminate the pain of the occasional loss by the thought that the policy that left you exposed to it will almost certainly be financially advantageous over the long run. A risk policy that aggregates decisions is analogous to the outside view of planning problems that I discussed earlier. The outside view shifts the focus from the specifics of the current situation to the statistics of outcomes in similar situations. The outside view is a broad frame for thinking about plans. A risk policy is a broad frame that embeds a particular risky choice in a set of similar choices. The outside view and the risk policy are remedies against two distinct biases that affect many decisions: the exaggerated optimism of the planning fallacy and the exaggerated caution induced by loss aversion. The two biases oppose each other. Exaggerated optimism protects individuals and organizations from the paralyzing effects of loss aversion. Loss aversion protects them from the follies of overconfident optimism. The upshot is rather comfortable for the decision maker. Optimists believe that the decisions they make are more prudent than they really are. And loss-averse decision makers correctly reject marginal propositions that they might otherwise accept. There is no guarantee, of course, that the biases cancel out in every situation. An organization that could eliminate both excessive optimism and excessive loss aversion should do so. The combination of the outside view with a risk policy should be the goal. Richard Thaler tells of a discussion about decision-making he had with the top managers of the 25 divisions of a large company. He asked them to consider a risky option in which, with equal probabilities, they could lose a large amount of the capital they controlled or earn double that amount. None of the executives was willing to take such a dangerous gamble. Thaler then turned to the CEO of the company, who was also present, and asked for his opinion. Without hesitation, the CEO answered, "I would like all of them to accept their risks." In the context of that conversation, it was natural for the CEO to adopt a broad frame that encompassed all 25 bets. Like Sam facing 100 coin tosses, he could count on statistical aggregation to mitigate the overall risk. Speaking of risk policies, tell her to think like a trader. You win a few, you lose a few. I decided to evaluate my portfolio only once a quarter. I am too loss-averse to make sensible decisions in the face of daily price fluctuations. They never buy extended warranties. That's their risk policy. Each of our executives is loss-averse in his or her domain. That's perfectly natural. But the result is that the organization is not taking enough risk. Chapter 32. Keeping Score. Except for the very poor, for whom income coincides with survival, the main motivators of money-seeking are not necessarily economic. For the billionaire looking for the extra billion, and indeed for the participant in an experimental economics project looking for the extra dollar, money is a proxy for points on a scale of self-regard and achievement. These rewards and punishments, promises and threats, are all in our heads. We carefully keep score of them. They shape our preferences and motivate our actions like the incentives provided in the social environment. As a result, we refuse to cut losses when doing so would admit failure. We are biased against actions that could lead to regret, and we draw an illusory but sharp distinction between omission and commission, not doing and doing, because the sense of responsibility is greater for one than for the other. The ultimate currency that rewards or punishes is often emotional, a form of mental self-dealing that inevitably creates conflicts of interest when the individual acts as an agent on behalf of an organization. Mental accounts. Richard Thaler has been fascinated for many years by analogies between the world of accounting and the mental accounts that we use to organize and run our lives, with results that are sometimes foolish and sometimes very helpful. Mental accounts come in several varieties. We hold our money in different accounts, which are sometimes physical, sometimes only mental. We have spending money, general savings, earmarked savings for our children's education or for medical emergencies. there is a clear hierarchy in our willingness to draw on these accounts to cover current needs. We use accounts for self-control purposes, as in making a household budget, limiting the daily consumption of espressos, or increasing the time spent exercising. Often we pay for self-control, for instance, simultaneously putting money in a savings account and maintaining debt on credit cards. The econs of the rational agent model do not resort to mental accounting. They have a comprehensive view of outcomes and are driven by external incentives. For humans, mental accounts are a form of narrow framing. They keep things under control and manageable by a finite mind. Mental accounts are used extensively to keep score. Recall that professional golfers putt more successfully when working to avoid a bogey than to achieve a birdie. One conclusion we can draw is that the best golfers create a separate account for each hole. They do not only maintain a single account for their overall success. An ironic example that Thaler related in an early article remains one of the best illustrations of how mental accounting affects behavior. Two avid sports fans plan to travel 40 miles to see a basketball game. One of them paid for his ticket. The other was on his way to purchase a ticket when he got one free from a friend. A blizzard is announced for the night of the game. Which of the two ticket holders is more likely to brave the blizzard to see the game? The answer is immediate. We know that the fan who paid for his ticket is more likely to drive. Mental accounting provides the explanation. We assume that both fans set up an account for the game they hope to see. Missing the game will close the accounts with a negative balance. Regardless of how they came by their ticket, both will be disappointed, but the closing balance is distinctly more negative for the one who bought the ticket and is now out of pocket, as well as deprived of the game. Because staying home is worse for this individual, he is more motivated to see the game and therefore more likely to make the attempt to drive into a blizzard. These are tacit calculations of emotional balance, of the kind that System 1 performs without deliberation. The emotions that people attach to the state of their mental accounts are not acknowledged in standard economic theory. An econ would realize that the ticket has already been paid for and cannot be returned. Its cost is sunk, and the econ would not care whether he had bought the ticket to the game or got it from a friend, if econs have friends. To implement this rational behavior, System 2 would have to be aware of the counterfactual possibility. Would I still drive into this snowstorm if I had gotten the ticket free from a friend? It takes an active and disciplined mind to raise such a difficult question. A related mistake afflicts individual investors when they sell stocks from their portfolio. You need money to cover the costs of your daughter's wedding and will have to sell some stock. You remember the price at which you bought each stock and can identify it as a winner, currently worth more than you paid for it, or as a loser. Among the stocks you own, Blueberry Tiles is a winner. If you sell it today, you will have achieved a gain of $5,000. You hold an equal investment in Tiffany Motors, which is currently worth $5,000 less than you paid for it. The value of both stocks has been stable in recent weeks. Which are you more likely to sell? A plausible way to formulate the choice is this. I could close the Blueberry Tiles account and score a success for my record as an investor. Alternatively, I could close the Tiffany Motors account and add a failure to my record. Which would I rather do? If the problem is framed as a choice between giving yourself pleasure and causing yourself pain, you will certainly sell Blueberry Tiles and enjoy your investment prowess. As might be expected, finance research has documented a massive preference for selling winners rather than losers, a bias that has been given an opaque label, the disposition effect. The disposition effect is an instance of narrow framing. The investor has set up an account for each share that she bought, and she wants to close every account as a gain. A rational agent would have a comprehensive view of the portfolio and sell the stock that is least likely to do well in the future, without considering whether it is a winner or a loser. Amos told me of a conversation with a financial advisor who asked him for a complete list of the stocks in his portfolio, including the price at which each had been purchased. When Amos asked mildly, "Isn't it supposed to not matter?" the advisor looked astonished. He had apparently always believed that the state of the mental account was a valid consideration. Amos's guess about the financial advisor's beliefs was probably right, but he was wrong to dismiss the buying price as irrelevant. The purchase price does matter and should be considered even by econs. The disposition effect is a costly bias because the question of whether to sell winners or losers has a clear answer, and it is not that it makes no difference. If you care about your wealth rather than your immediate emotions, you will sell the loser Tiffany Motors and hang on to the winning Blueberry Tiles. At least in the United States, taxes provide a strong incentive. Realizing losses reduces your taxes, while selling winners exposes you to taxes. This elementary fact of financial life is actually known to all American investors, and it determines the decisions they make during 1 month of the year. Investors sell more losers in December when taxes are on their mind. The tax advantage is available all year, of course, but for 11 months of the year, mental accounting prevails over financial common sense. Another argument against selling winners is the well-documented market anomaly that stocks that recently gained in value are likely to go on gaining at least for a short while. The net effect is large. The expected after-tax extra return of selling Tiffany rather than Blueberry is 3.4% over the next year. Closing a mental account with a gain is a pleasure, but it is a pleasure you pay for. The mistake is not one that an econ would ever make, and experienced investors who are using their system too are less susceptible to it than are novices. A rational decision maker is interested only in the future consequences of current investments. Justifying earlier mistakes is not among the econ's concerns. The decision to invest additional resources in a losing account, when better investments are available, is known as the sunk cost fallacy, a costly mistake that is observed in decisions large and small. Driving into the blizzard because one paid for tickets is a sunk cost error. Imagine a company that has already spent $50 million on a project. The project is now behind schedule, and the forecasts of its ultimate returns are less favorable than at the initial planning stage. An additional investment of $60 million is required to give the project a chance. An alternative proposal is to invest the same amount in a new project that currently looks likely to bring higher returns. What will the company do? All too often, a company afflicted by sunk costs drives into the blizzard, throwing good money after bad, rather than accepting the humiliation of closing the account of a costly failure. This situation is in the top right cell of the fourfold pattern in Figure 13, where the choice is between a sure loss and an unfavorable gamble, which is often unwisely preferred. The escalation of commitment to failing endeavors is a mistake from the perspective of the firm, but not necessarily from the perspective of the executive who owns a floundering project. Canceling the project will leave a permanent stain on the executive's record, and his personal interests are perhaps best served by gambling further with the organization's resources in the hope of recouping the original investment, or at least in an attempt to postpone the day of reckoning. In the presence of sunk costs, the manager's incentives are misaligned with the objectives of the firm and its shareholders, a familiar type of what is known as the agency problem. Boards of directors are well aware of these conflicts and often replace a CEO who is encumbered by prior decisions and reluctant to cut losses. The members of the board do not necessarily believe that the new CEO is more competent than the one she replaces. They do know that she does not carry the same mental accounts and is therefore better able to ignore the sunk costs of past investments in evaluating current opportunities. The sunk cost fallacy keeps people for too long in poor jobs, unhappy marriages, and unpromising research projects. I have often observed young scientists struggling to salvage a doomed project when they would be better advised to drop it and start a new one. Fortunately, research suggests that at least in some contexts, the fallacy can be overcome. The sunk cost fallacy is identified and taught as a mistake in both economics and business courses, apparently to good effect. There is evidence that graduate students in these fields are more willing than others to walk away from a failing project. Regret. Regret is an emotion, and it is also a punishment that we administer to ourselves. The fear of regret is a factor in many of the decisions that people make. "Don't do this, you will regret it," is a common warning. And the actual experience of regret is familiar. The emotional state has been well described by two Dutch psychologists who noted that regret is accompanied by feelings that one should have known better, by a sinking feeling, by thoughts about the mistake one has made and the opportunities lost, by a tendency to kick oneself and to correct one's mistake, and by wanting to undo the event and to get a second chance. Intense regret is what you experience when you can most easily imagine yourself doing something other than what you did. Regret is one of the counterfactual emotions that are triggered by the availability of alternatives to reality. After every plane crash, there are special stories about passengers who should not have been on the plane. They got a seat at the last moment. They were transferred from another airline they were supposed to fly a day earlier, but had to postpone. The common feature of these poignant stories is that they involve unusual events, and unusual events are easier than normal events to undo in imagination. Associative memory contains a representation of the normal world and its rules. An abnormal event attracts attention, and it also activates the idea of the event that would have been normal under the same circumstances. To appreciate the link of regret to normality, consider the following scenario. Mr. Brown almost never picks up hitchhikers. Yesterday, he gave a man a ride and was robbed. Mr. Smith frequently picks up hitchhikers. Yesterday, he gave a man a ride and was robbed. Whom do you expect to experience greater regret over the episode? The results are not surprising. 88% of respondents said Mr. Brown, 12% said Mr. Smith. Regret is not the same as blame. Other participants were asked this question about the same incident. Who will be criticized most severely by others? The results: Mr. Brown, 23%, Mr. Smith, 77%. Regret and blame are both evoked by a comparison to a norm, but the relevant norms are different. The emotions experienced by Mr. Brown and Mr. Smith are dominated by what they usually do about hitchhikers. Taking a hitchhiker is an abnormal event for Mr. Brown, and most people therefore expect him to experience more intense regret. A judgmental observer, however, will compare both men to conventional norms of reasonable behavior and is likely to blame Mr. Smith for habitually taking unreasonable risks. We are tempted to say that Mr. Smith deserved his fate and that Mr. Brown was unlucky. But Mr. Brown is the one who is more likely to be kicking himself, because he acted out of character in this one instance. Decision makers know that they are prone to regret, and the anticipation of that painful emotion plays a part in many decisions. Intuitions about regret are remarkably uniform and compelling, as the next example illustrates. Paul owns shares in Company A. During the past year, he considered switching to stock in Company B, but he decided against it. He now learns that he would have been better off by $1,200 if he had switched to the stock of Company B. George owned shares in Company B. During the past year, he switched to stock in Company A. He now learns that he would have been better off by $1,200 if he had kept his stock in Company B. Who feels greater regret? The results are clear-cut. 8% of respondents say Paul, 92% say George. This is curious because the situations of the two investors are objectively identical. They both now own stock A, and both would have been better off by the same amount if they owned stock B. The only difference is that George got to where he is by acting, whereas Paul got to the same place by failing to act. This short example illustrates a broad story. People expect to have stronger emotional reactions, including regret, to an outcome that is produced by action than to the same outcome when it is produced by inaction. This has been verified in the context of gambling. People expect to be happier if they gamble and win than if they refrain from gambling and get the same amount. The asymmetry is at least as strong for losses, and it applies to blame as well as to regret. The key is not the difference between commission and omission, but the distinction between fault options and actions that deviate from the default. When you deviate from the default, you can easily imagine the norm. And if the default is associated with bad consequences, the discrepancy between the two can be the source of painful emotions. The default option when you own a stock is not to sell it, but the default option when you meet your colleague in the morning is to greet him. Selling a stock and failing to greet your coworker are both departures from the default option and natural candidates for regret or blame. In a compelling demonstration of the power of default options, participants played a computer simulation of blackjack. Some players were asked, "Do you wish to hit?" while the others were asked, "Do you wish to stand?" Regardless of the question, saying yes was associated with much more regret than saying no if the outcome was bad. The question evidently suggests a default response, which is, "I don't have a strong wish to do it." It is the departure from the default that produces regret. Another situation in which action is the default is that of a coach whose team lost badly in their last game. The coach is expected to make a change of personnel or strategy, and a failure to do so will produce blame and regret. The asymmetry in the risk of regret favors conventional and risk-averse choices. The bias appears in many contexts. Consumers who are reminded that they may feel regret as a result of their choices show an increased preference for conventional options, favoring brand names over generics. The behavior of the managers of financial funds as the year approaches its end also shows an effect of anticipated evaluation. They tend to clean up their portfolios of unconventional and otherwise questionable stocks. Even life or death decisions can be affected. Imagine a physician with a gravely ill patient. One treatment fits the normal standard of care, another is unusual. The physician has some reason to believe that the unconventional treatment improves the patient's chances, but the evidence is inconclusive. The physician who prescribes the unusual treatment faces a substantial risk of regret, blame, and perhaps litigation. In hindsight, it will be easier to imagine the normal choice. the abnormal choice will be easy to undo. True, a good outcome will contribute to the reputation of the physician who dared, but the potential benefit is smaller than the potential cost, because success is generally a more normal outcome than is failure. Responsibility. Losses are weighted about twice as much as gains in several contexts. Choice between gambles, the endowment effect, and reactions to price changes. The loss aversion coefficient is much higher in some situations. In particular, you may be more loss averse for aspects of your life that are more important than money, such as health. Furthermore, your reluctance to sell important endowments increases dramatically when doing so might make you responsible for an awful outcome. Richard Thaler's early classic on consumer behavior included a compelling example, slightly modified in the following question. You have been exposed to a disease which, if contracted, leads to a quick and painless death within a week. The probability that you have the disease is 1 in 1,000. There is a vaccine that is effective only before any symptoms appear. What is the maximum you would be willing to pay for the vaccine? Most people are willing to pay a significant but limited amount. Facing the possibility of death is unpleasant, but the risk is small and it seems unreasonable to ruin yourself to avoid it. Now, consider a slight variation. Volunteers are needed for research on the above disease. All that is required is that you expose yourself to a 1 in 1,000 chance of contracting the disease. What is the minimum you would ask to be paid in order to volunteer for this program? You would not be allowed to purchase the vaccine. As you might expect, the fee that volunteers set is far higher than the price they were willing to pay for the vaccine. Thaler reported informally that a typical ratio is about 50 to 1. The extremely high selling price reflects two features of this problem. In the first place, you are not supposed to sell your health. The transaction is not considered legitimate, and the reluctance to engage in it is expressed in a higher price. Perhaps most important, you will be responsible for the outcome if it is bad. You know that if you wake up one morning with symptoms indicating that you will soon be dead, you will feel more regret in the second case than in the first, because you could have rejected the idea of selling your health without even stopping to consider the price. You could have stayed with the default option and done nothing, and now this counterfactual will haunt you for the rest of your life. The survey of parents' reactions to a potentially hazardous insecticide mentioned earlier also included a question about the willingness to accept increased risk. The respondents were told to imagine that they used an insecticide where the risk of inhalation and child poisoning was 15 per 10,000 bottles. A less expensive insecticide was available, for which the risk rose from 15 to 16 per 10,000 bottles. The parents were asked for the discount that would induce them to switch to the less expensive and less safe product. More than two-thirds of the parents in the survey responded that they would not purchase the new product at any price. They were evidently revolted by the very idea of trading the safety of their child for money. The minority who found a discount they could accept demanded an amount that was significantly higher than the amount they were willing to pay for a far larger improvement in the safety of the product. Anyone can understand and sympathize with the reluctance of parents to trade even a minute increase of risk to their child for money. It is worth noting, however, that this attitude is incoherent and potentially damaging to the safety of those we wish to protect. Even the most loving parents have finite resources of time and money to protect their child. The Keeping My Child Safe mental account has a limited budget, and it seems reasonable to deploy these resources in a way that puts them to the best use. Money that could be saved by accepting a minute increase in the risk of harm from a pesticide could certainly be put to better use in reducing the child's exposure to other harms, perhaps by purchasing a safer car seat or covers for electric sockets. The taboo trade-off against accepting any increase in risk is not an efficient way to use the safety budget. In fact, the resistance may be motivated by a selfish fear of regret more than by a wish to optimize the child's safety. The what-if thought that occurs to any parent who deliberately makes such a trade is an image of the regret and shame he or she would feel in the event the pesticide caused harm. The intense aversion to trading increased risk for some other advantage plays out on a grand scale in the laws and regulations governing risk. This trend is especially strong in Europe, where the precautionary principle, which prohibits any action that might cause harm, is a widely accepted doctrine. In the regularity context, the precautionary principle imposes the entire burden of proving safety on anyone who undertakes actions that might harm people or the environment. Multiple international bodies have specified that the absence of scientific evidence of potential damage is not sufficient justification for taking risks. As the jurist Cass Sunstein points out, the precautionary principle is costly, and when interpreted strictly, it can be paralyzing. He mentions an impressive list of innovations that would not have passed the test, including airplanes, air conditioning, antibiotics, automobiles, chlorine, the measles vaccine, open-heart surgery, radio, refrigeration, smallpox vaccine, and X-rays. The strong version of the precautionary principle is obviously untenable, but enhanced loss aversion is embedded in a strong and widely shared moral intuition. It is embedded in System 1. The dilemma between intensely loss-averse moral attitudes and efficient risk management does not have a simple and compelling solution. We spend much of our day anticipating and trying to avoid the emotional pains we inflict on ourselves. How seriously should we take these intangible outcomes, the self-administered punishments and occasional rewards that we experience as we score our lives? Econs are not supposed to have them, and they are costly to humans. They lead to actions that are detrimental to the wealth of individuals, to the soundness of policy, and to the welfare of society. But the emotions of regret and moral responsibility are real, and the fact that econs do not have them may not be relevant. Is it reasonable, in particular, to let your choices be influenced by the anticipation of regret? Susceptibility to regret, like susceptibility to fainting spells, is a fact of life to which one must adjust. If you are an investor sufficiently rich and cautious at heart, you may be able to afford the luxury of a portfolio that minimizes the expectation of regret, even if it does not maximize the accrual of wealth. You can also take precautions that will inoculate you against regret. Perhaps the most useful is to be explicit about the anticipation of regret. If you can remember when things go badly that you considered the possibility of regret carefully before deciding, you are likely to experience less of it. You should also know that regret and hindsight bias will come together, so anything you can do to preclude hindsight is likely to be helpful. My personal hindsight-avoiding policy is to be either very thorough or completely casual when making a decision with long-term consequences. Hindsight is worse when you think a little, just enough to tell yourself later, "I almost made a better choice." Daniel Gilbert and his colleagues provocatively claim that people generally anticipate more regret than they will actually experience, because they underestimate the efficacy of the psychological defenses they will deploy, which he labels the psychological immune system. Their recommendation is that you should not put too much weight on regret, even if you have some. It will hurt less than you now think. Speaking of keeping score, he has separate mental accounts for cash and credit purchases. I constantly remind him that money is money. We are hanging on to that stock just to avoid closing our mental account at a loss. It's the disposition effect. We discovered an excellent dish at that restaurant, and we never try anything else to avoid regret. The salesperson showed me the most expensive car seat and said it was the safest, and I could not bring myself to buy the cheaper model. It felt like a taboo trade-off. Chapter 33. Reversals. You have the task of setting compensation for victims of violent crimes. You consider the case of a man who lost the use of his right arm as a result of a gunshot wound. He was shot when he walked in on a robbery occurring in a convenience store in his neighborhood. Two stores were located near the victim's home, one of which he frequented more regularly than the other. Consider two scenarios. One, the burglary happened in the man's regular store. Two, the man's regular store was closed for a funeral, so he did his shopping in the other store, where he was shot. Should the store in which the man was shot make a difference to his compensation? You made your judgment in joint evaluation, where you consider two scenarios at the same time and make a comparison. You can apply a rule. If you think that the second scenario deserves higher compensation, you should assign it a higher dollar value. There is almost universal agreement on the answer. Compensation should be the same in both situations. The compensation is for the crippling injury, so why should the location in which it occurred make any difference? The joint evaluation of the two scenarios gave you a chance to examine your moral principles about the factors that are relevant to victim compensation. For most people, location is not one of these factors. As in other situations that require an explicit comparison, thinking was slow and System 2 was involved. The psychologists Dale Miller and Kathy McFarland, who originally designed the two scenarios, presented them to different people for single evaluation. In their between subjects experiment, each participant saw only one scenario and assigned a dollar value to it. They found, as you surely guessed, that the victim was awarded a much larger sum if he was shot in a store he rarely visited than if he was shot in his regular store. Poignancy, a close cousin of regret, is a counterfactual feeling, which is evoked because the thought, "if only he had shopped at his regular store," comes readily to mind. The familiar System 1 mechanisms of substitution and intensity matching translate the strength of the emotional reaction to the story onto a monetary scale, creating a large difference in dollar awards. The comparison of the two experiments reveals a sharp contrast. Almost everyone who sees both scenarios together, within subject, endorses the principle that poignancy is not a legitimate consideration. Unfortunately, the principle becomes relevant only when the two scenarios are seen together, and this is not how life usually works. We normally experience life in the between subjects mode, in which contrasting alternatives that might change your mind are absent. And, of course, what you see is all there is. As a consequence, the beliefs that you endorse when you reflect about morality do not necessarily govern your emotional reactions, and the moral intuitions that come to your mind in different situations are not internally consistent. The discrepancy between single and joint evaluation of the burglary scenario belongs to a broad family of reversals of judgment and choice. The first preference reversals were discovered in the early 1970s, and many reversals of other kinds were reported over the years. Challenging economics. Preference reversals have an important place in the history of the conversation between psychologists and economists. The reversals that attracted attention were reported by Sarah Lichtenstein and Paul Slovic, two psychologists who had done their graduate work at the University of Michigan at the same time as Amos. They conducted an experiment on preferences between bets, which I show in a slightly simplified version. You are offered a choice between two bets, which are to be played on a roulette wheel with 36 sectors. Bet A, 11 out of 36 to win $160, 25 out of 36 to lose $15. Bet B, 35 out of 36 to win $40, 1 out of 36 to lose $10. You are asked to choose between a safe bet and a riskier one, an almost certain win of a modest amount, or a small chance to win a substantially larger amount and a high probability of losing. Safety prevails, and B is clearly the more popular choice. Now consider each bet separately. If you owned that bet, what is the lowest price at which you would sell it? Remember that you are not negotiating with anyone. Your task is to determine the lowest price at which you would truly be willing to give up the bet. Try it. You may find that the prize that can be won is salient in this task, and that your evaluation of what the bet is worth is anchored on that value. The results support this conjecture, and the selling price is higher for bet A than for bet B. This is a preference reversal. People choose B over A, but if they imagine owning only one of them, they set a higher value on A than on B. As in the burglary scenarios, the preference reversal occurs because joint evaluation focuses attention on an aspect of the situation, the fact that bet A is much less safe than bet B, which was less salient in single evaluation. The features that caused the difference between the judgments of the options in single evaluation, the poignancy of the victim being in the wrong grocery store and the anchoring on the prize, are suppressed or irrelevant when the options are evaluated jointly. The emotional reactions of System 1 are much more likely to determine single evaluation. The comparison that occurs in joint evaluation always involves a more careful and effortful assessment, which calls for System 2. The preference reversal can be confirmed in a within-subject experiment, in which subjects set prices on both sets as part of a long list, and also choose between them. Participants are unaware of the inconsistency, and their reactions when confronted with it can be entertaining. A 1968 interview of a participant in the experiment, conducted by Sarah Lichtenstein, is an enduring classic of the field. The experimenter talks at length with a bewildered participant who chooses one bet over another, but is then willing to pay money to exchange the item he just chose for the one he just rejected, and goes through the cycle repeatedly. Rational econs would surely not be susceptible to preference reversals, and the phenomenon was therefore a challenge to the rational agent model and to the economic theory that is built on this model. The challenge could have been ignored, but it was not. A few years after the preference reversals were reported, two respected economists, David Grether and Charles Plott, published an article in the prestigious American Economic Review, in which they reported their own studies of the phenomenon that Lichtenstein and Slovic had described. This was probably the first finding by experimental psychologists that ever attracted the attention of economists. The introductory paragraph of Grether and Plott's article was unusually dramatic for a scholarly paper, and their intent was clear. A body of data and theory has been developing within psychology which should be of interest to economists. Taken at face value, the data are simply inconsistent with preference theory and have broad implications about research priorities.